Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The first thing the baggage agent noticed at the Los Angeles train depot on October 18, 1931, was the odor. It wasn't emanating from the passengers who had arrived aboard the overnight Phoenix to LA train, though a little BO would have been excused considering the long ride and cramped quarters. But no, this stench clearly came from the checked luggage. Upon closer inspection, the culprits were obvious. Two trunks had been checked in Phoenix, heavy trunks, like abnormally heavy. The bulkier of the two weighed more than 200 pounds, while the smaller was still 100 plus. But it wasn't the size of the trunks that drew baggage agent Arthur Anderson's attention. It was the smell and the oozing. After all of the train's luggage had been pulled from a storage compartment and lined up on a flatbed truck, the oozing was impossible to ignore. It was ruddy in color, viscous, and unsettling. Anderson instinctively knew it had to be blood. That, matched with the deathly stench that accompanied it, led him to jump to an unnerving conclusion. Surely, there was something dead inside these trunks. But Anderson was much more generous with his next thought than he could have been. Instead of worrying about, say, human remains, he assumed the carcass, or carcasses, inside of the sickening trunks belonged to deer. It sounds a little naive, but it was a reasonable deduction. Deer meat was regularly smuggled aboard trains in those days, particularly out west to California, where venison sold as a delicacy for top dollar. As you can imagine, health officials weren't too keen on this, especially considering the method of transport. Jamming a deer inside a trunk and letting it sit for hours aboard a train doesn't sound sanitary, because it isn't. Anderson put a pink tag on the two trunks that signified they were not to be released without further investigation. The passenger traveling with the trunks deboarded the train and made a beeline for the ladies' room. She was an attractive but nervous-looking woman wearing a drab brown suit and hauling two additional carry-on bags, a new-looking hatbox, and a noticeably tattered brown case that suggested the woman must not be a person of means. Her name was Winnie Ruth Judd, though she often went by Ruth or Ruthie. No one at the train depot paid her much mind the morning of her arrival outside of a bathroom attendant named Stella Conley, who agreed to let her stash those two extra bags in the restroom for a bit. Hours passed before Ruth, who had confided to Stella that she was waiting for a younger brother to come fetch her, left the depot promising to return. When she did, she had a tall fellow with reddish blonde hair in tow, and an angry train man waiting for her. It was now late afternoon, and the already leaking, stinking trunks had been festering outside since before 8 a.m. Flies circled the luggage when Ruth and her brother approached. Arthur Anderson demanded she unlock the trunks. He later testified, quote, "I told her that whatever was leaking would undoubtedly damage the rest of the contents. I didn't want her to later file a claim against the railroad for what was ruined, so we should determine the extent of the problem now," end quote. Her brother, Burton McKinnell, offered a compromise. "It might cause some embarrassment to open the trunks here," he said. "Why not come out to the house and examine the contents there?" "No thanks," said Anderson. So Ruth fumbled through her purse for keys with her right hand, prompting Anderson to notice that her left hand was all bandaged up. But wouldn't you know it, Ruth didn't have the keys after all. She said she'd have to retrieve them from her husband, so she and her brother left, promising to be back in a jiffy with the keys. Of course, they never came back. Anderson finally lost patience and called the Los Angeles Police Department about the disgustingly odd trunks left at his station. Detective Frank Ryan picked the lock of the bigger trunk first, fighting past the odor. He lifted some blood-smeared clothing and a rag and found he was staring down at the face of a dark-haired woman. The rest of the woman's body, eerily clad in pajamas, was folded inside the trunk. Detective Ryan stumbled backward, called for some help, regained his composure, and picked the lock to the second trunk. Inside was the body of a second woman, or most of a body anyway. The corpse had been sliced with surgical precision into four sections. All the sections were inside the second trunk, except for the area beneath the victim's pelvis to the top of her knees. That part would soon be found in one of the other bags Winnie Ruth Judd had left inside the station bathroom. Now, given the circumstances, it could have proved tough to identify these women, what with them having been shoved in suitcases and shipped cross-country. But it wasn't hard, because whoever had packed them away had included identifying bits of paper with them. Quickly, police knew their identities, as reported in this 1990s episode of Inside Edition.
The two bodies were identified as 24-year-old Helvig Sammy Samuelson and 32-year-old Ann LeRoy. They were Winnie Ruth Judd's best friends.
The sensational tone of that clip is fitting here, because the case against Ruth would soon become a nationwide media circus, with her story dominating newspapers not just in LA, where the bodies were found, or Phoenix, where the killings had happened, but all across America and beyond. She would be called the Tiger Woman, the Blonde Butcher, the Blonde Borgia, and finally, the name that would really stick, the Trunk Murderess. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hiya Health Products. I've seen other moms with kids who eat everything. My nephew Ollie's favorite food is literally sushi, and the kid is 11. My 10-year-old, however, has about 5 things he'll willingly eat, and 3 of those things are pizza. So of course I try to fill in the gaps for him with a good vitamin, but I swear that typical children's vitamins are basically candy in disguise. Enter here Hiya. Hiya fills in the most common gaps in modern children's diets to provide the full body nourishment our kids need with a yummy taste they love, and they do that while being made with zero sugar and zero gummy junk. Yet my kid still likes how they taste, which is nothing short of a miracle. Formulated with the help of nutritional experts for kids 2 and up, Hiya is pressed with a blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies, then supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, folate, and many others. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/COTC. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to hiyahealth.com/COTC and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. The idea that Winnie Ruth Judd would ever make headlines at all would likely have never crossed the minds of her friends and family. She was petite, demure. In the late 20s and early 30s, she wore the short bobbed hairstyle that had become the fashion, but it fits her personality that she was a late adopter of the style. She wasn't the type to defy culture norms and cut her locks at the outset of the trend. Her one attribute that did garner attention was her looks. From a Briefcase documentary,
she was glamorous, beautiful, and very photogenic.
He sounds really excited about that, doesn't he? But he's right. She had dark, finger-waved hair framing an oval face with eyes that remind me of that old silent movie star Lillian Gish. She was downright stunning, which of course mattered, because it would play a significant role in why this case catapulted her into just about every newspaper in the country. Ruth's upbringing offered no foreshadowing of her future notoriety. She grew up in Darlington, Indiana as Ruth McKinnell, the daughter of Minister Harvey McKinnell and his wife, Carrie, a homemaker. According to the 1910 census, the couple had 2 children 3 years apart. Ruth, who was then 6 years old, and her younger brother, Burton, who was 3. It's worth noting that mom and dad at that point were 44 and 50 years old, respectively, meaning that both were on the older side for the era when they started their family. I'll also note, by the way, that the couple in 1910 reported that they had been married 6 years and Ruth was 6 years old. It implies that the marriage just might have averted a crisis for the minister. Anyway, when Ruth was young, she began to tell tales that, in short, worried her folks.
When she was in her teens, she told her parents that she was pregnant. Her parents were very concerned and took her to a doctor who examined her and announced that Winnie was in fact still a virgin, so was not pregnant. Later, she ran away from home, and when she returned, she claimed to have been kidnapped and had had a baby. But on examination, she had not given birth.
Her parents largely shrugged off the incidents as the acts of an immature girl trying to get attention, though they did quietly worry that she might have some psychological issues. Apparently, those ran in the minister's side of the family. Whatever the case, the drama seemed to calm, and after Ruth left home, she got a job at the Indiana State Hospital doing secretarial work. And that's where she met her first serious beau. He was a doctor, 22 years her senior. The two married when Ruth was still a teenager, and still a virgin, which I note only because she had a few more of those pregnancy delusions along the way. No one ever was able to pinpoint the cause. Her parents were hopeful that Ruth's new husband, a World War I veteran named William Judd, would prove to be a great provider for their daughter, but that turned out to not quite be the case. While Ruth and William seemed to love each other, the doctor battled a secret addiction to narcotics that kept interfering with his ability to keep a job. Instead of settling into a comfortable life as a small-town doctor somewhere, which is what Ruth and her parents had anticipated, he instead worked sporadically as a doctor for American companies employing minors in Mexico. It didn't pay well, but it was work, and it did offer living accommodations, sparse though they were. But Dr. Judd couldn't even keep those gigs very long. Ruth would write her parents letters blaming their constant moving on the depression or personality clashes at her husband's job. She never spilled to her folks that she had married a drug addict who she sometimes had to babysit overnight to make sure he didn't choke on his own vomit. Later, Ruth would say that her husband's addiction could be traced to an injury he sustained during the war, which might well be true. The fact is, addictive drugs weren't as safely guarded back then, meaning that addiction was pretty common, yet also completely stigmatized. Keeping Dr. Judd's condition under wraps was of utmost importance if the couple wanted to avoid causing a scandal. Less stigmatized was Ruth's medical condition. She had contracted tuberculosis in her youth, and it had kept her on the weaker side as she entered adulthood. It's hard now to fathom a disease like this, one so dangerous and indiscriminate that, as the principal cause of death in 17th century Europe, it was dubbed the White Plague. The white part of the name came from the ashen pallor of its victims, by the way. When the plague passed, the disease would still be called the White Death. But TB dates way back further than that. From a brief history of TB by the Microbiology Society.
The earliest physical evidence in humans can be traced back to 9,000 years ago. Archaeologists found TB in the remains of a mother and child in the ancient city of Atlit Yam, which is now under the Mediterranean Sea.
I'll note here that the choice of music in this documentary is not mine. It makes me want a vacation on a beach, not learn about a deadly disease.
Historians can often trace diseases through written accounts, and the first recorded mentions of TB in writing were in India, 3,300 years ago.
From the beginning, it was tough to tease out what the cause of this horrible disease was, and more importantly, what a treatment might be. In the Middle Ages, people thought that the quote-unquote royal touch could cure it, so thousands of people were touched by monarchs over hundreds of years. Yet, people kept dying. In the 18th and 19th centuries, TB was still an epidemic, with a mortality rate around 900 deaths per 100,000 population in Western Europe, the UK, and North America. TB killed about a quarter of the adult population of Europe in the 19th century.
In early 19th century New England, TB, or consumption as it was known, were thought to be caused by vampires. As the infection spread quickly through families, people believed that this was due to the deceased TB sufferer draining the life from other family members. It even went as far as bodies being dug up and burned to stop the vampire from attacking and preventing the spread of the disease.
Scientists, of course, didn't buy this nonsense, but they had trouble rebutting it because they didn't know the real cause. A breakthrough came when doctors who had autopsied the victims began to realize that they were consistently seeing lesions in their lungs. But the biggest revelation came on March 24th, 1882.
German scientist Robert Koch demonstrated that TB was indeed a bacterial infectious disease. This and other scientific advancements led to the development of the BCG vaccine in 1921, which is still used today.
It took time, though, for this vaccine to be embraced. So by 1931, people with TB were still dealing with it as it had been dealt with for decades. Because it was a bacterial infection of the lungs, folks caught on that living in wet climates made them feel far worse than drier climates, so plenty of TB patients made their way out west, if not to live there permanently, at least to set up roots long enough for whatever flare-up they were enduring to subside. That's how Winnie Ruth Judd landed in Phoenix. Her husband's inability to keep a job, matched with her energy-sapping disease, left her feeling constantly exhausted. So she and Dr. Judd agreed in 1930 that she should settle down in the bustling city's dry climate. The plan was for Ruth to get a job, which she did. First, she found work helping a local family, and then she got a job as a medical secretary at Phoenix's first private medical clinic. In truth, she might not have been hired if she hadn't fudged a bit and claimed she was proficient in typing when she really wasn't. But what she lacked in that arena, she made up for in hustle, enrolling in a night class to improve her typing skills. She also was known to often work on her only day off each week to make sure she didn't fall behind on her duties. In exchange, the Grunau Clinic paid $75 a month. That translates to about $1,500 a month nowadays, which sounds tight, because it is. That's the equivalent of an $18,000 annual salary. Tough to live on. In short, this wasn't good money, but it was the best Ruth could hope for as an unskilled, untrained woman in those days. The salary paid her rent and bought her food, and whatever was left, Ruth would try to slip to her husband. He had hoped to land a job in Phoenix, but nothing materialized. He bounced back to Mexico a few times to work short stints there, then traveled to California in hopes of landing something. Ruth didn't know a soul in Phoenix when she arrived, but she soon befriended a co-worker named Annie Leroy, who lived with another friend named Hedvig Samuelson, though everyone called her Sammy. Anne and Sammy were inseparable. Anne was the older of the two and the caretaker, a role necessitated by Sammy's own TB infection. As weak as Ruth could get sometimes, Sammy's situation was far worse. She couldn't work at all and relied on Anne to keep her fed, dressed, and housed. Still, TB is an odd disease in that it comes in waves, and when Sammy was feeling more energetic, she and Anne hosted parties and dinners and card games in the rented home. Once Ruth entered the picture, the trio became best friends, and Ruth met new gentlemen who paid her attention and compliments. It was a bit risque for Phoenix, which in this era was described by journalist Jana Bommersbach this way, quote, "Life revolved around family and home and a strict moral code that said a man was required to be faithful and productive for his family, a woman was to raise her children to be God-fearing and successful, and the kids were to stay out of trouble. Divorce was the most horrible admission that somebody wasn't following the script, and playing around was scandalous." End quote. Ruth would later talk somewhat fondly of the days when she broke those rules and, indeed, played around. But her nicest memories revolved around Anne and Sammy, her two new best friends. Ruth would later insist she loved those girls and was just heartbroken that she'd had to kill them. Crimes This Century is sponsored by Field of Greens. I've been using Field of Greens for a few weeks now, and it's to the point where I miss it if I forget it first thing in the morning. I add one scoop of Field of Greens to my water, and through that, I get a full serving of vegetables and a full serving of fruit to kick off my day. I swear it feels like the healthiest thing I do for myself, and it tastes great. I've tried two flavors so far, the original and the wild berry, and I love them both. Here's what I noticed since taking Field of Greens. I feel like it helps with digestion, I haven't been napping as much during the day, and I generally feel like my skin looks healthier. Now, I talked with a company rep recently, and she told me that Field of Greens is radically different. It's made with real USDA organic fruits and veggies, not extracts, which means it has a nutritional label on it like food has. It's not a supplement. And each organic fruit and vegetable used in the products were medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I think you're going to love this product, but if for any reason you don't, they'll give you a 100% money back guarantee. I got you 15% off your first order plus free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code COTC. That's promo code COTC at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. After police discovered the remains of Anne LeRoy and Sammy Samuelson spread among four pieces of luggage delivered from Phoenix to Los Angeles, they quickly deduced the name of the attractive woman with whom the bags had traveled. It wasn't hard. Winnie Ruth Judd had straight up given her name to Stella Conley, the restroom attendant at the depot who had let Ruth stash her smallest baggage in the bathroom. Soon, news bulletins hit the presses about the, quote, slight blonde woman of 27 years, wife of a physician and daughter of a minister, end quote. As reported in a story headlined, Two Women Murdered, in Alaska's The Cusco Times, Ruth was the, quote, prey of the squads of detectives thrown into an all-encompassing search, end quote. That story, like many to follow in the immediate aftermath of the grisly discovery, erroneously reported that Ruth's brother, Burton, told police his sister had confessed to the crime before fleeing. Burton would later clarify that wasn't true. His sister had only told him that she wanted him to take the trunks to the ocean and sink them. When he asked why, she refused to answer, saying the less Burton knew, the better off he'd be. Now, that wasn't the only error made in those early days of the story. One article claimed Ruth had fed parts of the victims to her pet cat. Another said she had previously tried to poison Anne LeRoy, despite there being no evidence of that. And nearly every story described Sammy Samuelson as having been butchered, chopped into pieces. But that wasn't quite true either. Jana Bommersbach, author of The Trunk Murderess, talking with journalist Brianna Whitney on the podcast True Crime Arizona.
This body was cut up through the spine. You have got to be a doctor to know how to cut a human body up through the spine, because there's only certain places you can cut in order to sever that spinal cord, because that goes all the way down the back. This body was cut up so precisely that they sewed it back together.
People who have seen the autopsy photos attest that's true. Rather than having been chopped into pieces, Sammy's remains were cleanly divided into four parts that, once reassembled on the coroner's slab, were sewn together for an easier autopsy. And that points to those early stories likely getting one thing right. They suggested that even if Ruth had killed Anne and Sammy, she couldn't have done it alone, or at least not handled the aftermath solo, because the bodies, Anne's whole corpse and Sammy's dismembered one, would have been awfully heavy for Ruth alone to pack into the trunks. She was, after all, a small woman, who had tuberculosis, no less. She recruited neighbors to help her haul the two heftiest trunks from her rental home to the train depot, and those helpers had to work together to lift the bigger trunk containing Anne. Plus, there was another reason Ruth seemed unlikely to have handled the dismembering and packaging of her friends by herself. When she was finally located days after the nationwide manhunt for her began, she had a gangrenous left hand in which a bullet had been lodged. She could barely move it. Her explanation threw a wrench into prosecutors' already circulating theory that Ruth had shot her two best friends in a premeditated fit of jealousy. By painting her as such, Ruth not only faced first-degree murder charges, but she faced the death penalty. What Ruth said actually happened was this. She had gone to Sammy and Ann's house that night and gotten into an argument, during which Sammy produced a gun. Ruth reached for the gun with one hand while grabbing at a kitchen knife with the other. Sammy fired the gun into Ruth's outstretched hand as Ruth swung the knife at Sammy's shoulder, making a small cut. Then Ruth wrested the gun away from Sammy. It was a battle between two small, sickly women, but with Ruth being the healthier of the two at the moment, she won, spun the gun around, and fired at Sammy. Anne, meanwhile, grabbed an ironing board and attacked Ruth by smashing her repeatedly, screaming that she would brain her to death. The battle over the gun resumed as Ruth's first shot into Sammy wasn't fatal. Anne, still hitting Ruth with the ironing board, screamed at Sammy to shoot her again. Instead, though, it was Ruth who shot again, then turned and fired a single shot into Anne's head. After that, Ruth said she blacked out. When she came to, the women were all sprawled in the kitchen. Both of her friends appeared dead. She made her way back to her own house, and that's where she found one of Phoenix's most beloved entrepreneurs dead drunk on her stoop. His name was Jack Halloran, and he was Ruth's lover. From Inside Edition.
Jack Halloran was a prominent businessman married and the father of three. His family was among the elite of Phoenix.
Halloran was a handsome, broad-shouldered man who ran a lumber yard and was touted as one of Phoenix's success stories. At 44 years old, he lived with his wife and three children in one of the city's posher neighborhoods. Bommersbach described him as a take-charge kind of guy whose laugh could fill a room. Ruth had met him during a brief job she'd had as a caretaker before she landed at the Grunau Clinic. The family for whom Ruth worked had lived near Halloran, who took an instant liking to the young, beautiful woman. Now, as I mentioned, Phoenix presented itself as quite prim and proper in these days, back when the population was just 48,000. More than 1.6 million people live there today. But in truth, its superiority complex was unfounded. It had just as many vices as any other city. It just happened to be small enough and close-knit enough that it was easy to keep those vices under the radar. Jack Halloran ran with the city's elite. These were high-ranking people, politicians, judges, businessmen, and the like. I looked up his name in a newspaper database to get a sense of what kind of press he got before this case, and it was stuff about Halloran helping to auction off meals to benefit a Kiwanis club, or organizing a state golf tournament, or serving as toastmaster for the Concatenated Order of Hoo-Hoo of Arizona. If you're curious, that's a fraternal and service organization that, during Halloran's era, was open to only white men over age 21 engaged in the lumber industry. In most of those stories, his name was alongside others whose ended in, say, Esquire.
Man, I mean, this guy was a player. He was an important businessman in town. He owned a lumber yard. He was on the board of directors of the country club. His picture still hangs on the Phoenix Country Club. Everybody knew who he was.
And everybody knew that he liked to party. He was a frequent guest at the little soirees Ann and Sammy hosted. Ruth had introduced him to the pair, and he was player enough that he made overtures to those women, too. He provided them money to pay their rent and gave them a $50 radio as a gift. Reminder, Ruth's monthly salary was $75. Halloran's name at first wasn't connected to the grisly murders as the nationwide search was underway looking for Ruth, and Ruth proved tricky to find. Most people expected she'd be found within hours, but one day passed and then another. Police all over the Los Angeles area scoured cheap motels and followed up on tips from well-intentioned but frustratingly wrong callers. Ruth had lived in California a stint while her husband was bouncing around jobs, plus her family lived there too, so they checked in with family and old friends, but nothing surfaced. Police back in Phoenix checked her usual haunts just in case she had managed to make her way back there. Officials worried she might jet off to Mexico. Her time living there with Dr. Judd had left her fluent in Spanish, so she'd likely get by for quite a while. In reality, though, Ruth was hiding in plain sight. She went to a sanitarium where she had once been treated for her tuberculosis. She didn't even check herself in. She just wandered the place until she found an empty room and slept in it for 4 days. She was basically in a stupor. Finally, she got up, brushed her hair, and walked out of the sanitarium and headed to a department store where she had once worked. In a letter she would later write, Ruth wrote, quote, I stood around staring at people I knew or who knew me. I was in such a stupor that I got locked in the store all night. I slept in the furniture department of that store under a rug. When I awakened the next morning, people were rushing around me, going about their business, end quote. While hidden, Ruth wrote a letter to her dear Dr. Judd to say goodbye. Exhausted, hungry, and alone, she was contemplating suicide and wanted to explain things to him so he'd understand her version. She changed her mind about wanting to end her life, though, so she tore the letter up and shoved it down a drain inside her department store hideout. Later, the store's plumber found the letter, which police pieced back together to use in the trial accusing her of cold-blooded murder. When police finally did find Ruth, it was because she, at the urging of her husband, turned herself in. That she had been hiding in such obvious places only further humiliated the police. In short, they'd done a shoddy job of investigating and worked far harder at hiding that fact than they ever did at figuring out what precisely happened the night Ann LeRoy and Sammy Samuelson died. Crimes of Centuries is sponsored by Factor. You know what I find tough? Eating healthy with how busy I am. It can be really hard when you're rushing from one thing to the next and then you have to figure out what to put in your mouth to boot. But eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. And there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled and feeling good all day long. So what does Factor have? Well, I'll tell you. They've got pancakes, they've got smoothies, they've got loaded mashed potatoes and shredded chicken. There's no prep and no mess. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, and they're flexible for your schedule. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast premium options with no cooking required. Head to factormeals.com/COTC50 and use code COTC50 to get 50% off. That's code COTC50 at factormeals.com/COTC50 to get 50% off. The quote-unquote drainpipe letter that Winnie Ruth Judd wrote her husband inside the Broadway department store in LA was considered clutch evidence in her murder case. Parts of the letter had supposedly been reprinted in newspapers nationwide, featuring quotes like, I knew that Mrs. LeRoy would give me up to the authorities, so I had to kill her too. Sammy shot me through the hand, I grappled with her and finally gained possession of the gun. Then I shot her twice. I had to kill Mrs. LeRoy to keep her from giving me up. It's a dramatic quote. Too bad it wasn't accurate. The letter said nothing about killing Ann, aka Mrs. LeRoy, to avoid being given up to the police. Nor did it otherwise confirm the premeditation theory police and prosecutors presented to jurors. Rather, what the letter said, and what Ruth maintained until the end of her life, was that she and her friends got into a terrible quarrel that day that escalated to violence. What that quarrel was about was never clearly articulated in the day's newspapers because it was considered too crude. But the gist is this. Ruth had introduced a new nurse named Lucille Moore to Jack Halloran and the other men who routinely frequented Anne and Sammy's house parties. That nurse had syphilis, which was a far more stigmatized disease than pesky old TB. People did not talk about sexually transmitted infections, particularly syphilis, even though in the 1930s, about 1 out of every 10 Americans suffered from syphilis, according to the Cleveland Clinic. Ann and Sammy likely didn't want their party-going men, who also financially helped them, spread any thinner, so it's hard to say if their true reason for being so upset about Jack and Co. meeting Lucille Moore was really about her STI or not. Regardless, Ruth said her friends were furious with her and accused her of putting Halloran's life in danger by letting Lucille cross paths with him. From True Crime Documentary.
Ruth rebutted by saying that, firstly, she didn't expect Jack to be interested in Moore romantically. And secondly, if it was true about the woman's affliction, such information should remain in the clinic and not be made public.
This apparently didn't assuage the women, who called Ruth names, including a slut for cheating on her husband, and threatened to first tell her husband about her and Halloran, and then tell Halloran about Lucille's syphilis, which Ruth knew would result in Jack cutting her out of his life. Ruth stood to lose both of her men, a husband she claimed to love despite her extracurricular activities, and Jack, upon whom she relied not just for companionship, but also for money here and there. Ruth fought back, not physically at this point, but verbally. She said that all of her and Anne's co-workers whispered behind their backs that Anne and Sammy were perverts, queers, the terms of the day for lesbians. Ruth said if they turned her in for endangering Jack, she'd simply confirm the rumors that the two women were lovers and ruin their reputations just as badly as hers would be ruined. That's when, according to Ruth, Sammy got the gun. After the shootings, and after Ruth ran home to find Jack Halloran drunk on her doorstep, she told him what had happened. Jack flat out didn't believe her. So she led him back to Anne and Sammy's home and walked him inside, where he saw the carnage. He seemed to sober up quickly, barking orders at Ruth about what to do and how to clean. Ruth said she couldn't do much of the latter because she only had the one working hand. Jack softened and reassured her that everything would be fine. He fished out a big trunk of Sammy's and began prepping to put both bodies inside of it. He sent Ruth back to her house and promised that he'd take care of it all. He admonished her to never, ever say anything to anyone, particularly her husband. The next day, though, Jack called her and said he wasn't going to be able to take care of things as promised. Ruth said she desperately wanted to get out to LA to see her family, which gave Halloran a grand idea. Why don't you take the trunk with you? Ruth said no way, no how. But Jack had quite a hold on her, and eventually she agreed to the plan. At the time, both bodies were jammed into one trunk, though Jack told Ruth that Sammy had been quote-unquote operated on. It wasn't until later, when the trunk was back at Ruth's place, that she figured out what that meant. Ruth had realized the one trunk was so damned heavy that she couldn't travel with it, so she decided she would need to use a second trunk. When she opened the first, she saw Sammy had been dismembered. She put three of the four segments of Sammy's body into a smaller trunk, then put the fourth into yet another smaller, rattier suitcase, and then she asked neighbors for help getting all her parcels to the train station. After the horrific discovery in LA, Jack occasionally got messages to Ruth assuring her that he would come through for her, but he never did. While his name was mentioned often during her trial, he was never called to testify. He let her take the rap alone, which ended up being extra disastrous because her defense lawyers didn't do much right by her either. Instead of letting her plead her case that she had killed in self-defense, which at most would have gotten her a manslaughter conviction, they opted to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. The self-defense part was never presented. It's not as though there hadn't been time.
The trial went on for quite a while.
This is Charles Arnold, one of the original investigators in the case, being interviewed for a 1969 news report. In it, he made clear his belief that Ruth hadn't attacked to defend herself. Here, he's describing parts of his interrogation with Ruth back in 1931.
Now, I said, let me tell you the story. I said, you went out there with this gun to kill these women because this one woman had rejected your love. Isn't that right? And I said, you found them sound asleep, and you had a key to the door, so you went quietly in there to where they were sleeping. Isn't that right, Ruthie? Then I said, when you cut them up down there in the bathtub, I said, you want to make this story good about fighting, so I said, you shot yourself through the hand, didn't you? No, I never had any gun. Oh, yes, Ruthie, you had a gun. and a little automatic. Same gun that you shot the women with.
So much for keeping an open mind. Anyway, the jury was told that the only way they could find Winnie Ruth Judd not guilty of murder was to agree that she was insane, and the only way they could deem her insane was to determine that she didn't know right from wrong. The jury decided she must have known right from wrong. Hiding the bodies to cover up the crime fit that bill, they figured. Why would someone bother covering up something they didn't think was wrong? Ruth was convicted and sentenced to hang. In the meantime, Jack Halloran was finally charged as Ruth's accomplice, but that trial turned into what's known in the legal community as a total shit show. Ruth, who hadn't been allowed to testify in her first trial, got on the stand this time and screamed, ranted, and raved, arguing with the judge, scaring the jurors, all sorts of things. But she did also manage to convince everyone in the courtroom that she had shot Anne and Sammy in self-defense. And because it was self-defense, it wasn't a crime, and because it wasn't a crime, Jack Halloran couldn't be found guilty of aiding and abetting because there was no crime to aid or abet. So Halloran was acquitted, and Ruth went back to prison to await her death penalty because the second jury's decision had no bearing over the original jury's verdict and sentencing. It was, in short, a weird situation, but some good came of it, kind of. Public sentiment had shifted to Ruth's side, and the outcry got her another insanity hearing, which this time resulted in her being declared insane. Instead of being executed, she was sent to a state hospital where she got along quite well, at least when she had overseers who were somewhat nice to her. When jailers changed or wardens turned cruel, Judd would escape the hospital, make headlines all over again, eventually be discovered, and finally land back in state custody. She escaped seven times between the late 1930s and the early 60s. The last time she escaped, she managed to adopt a new persona and get a caregiving job in a rich family's home. But eventually, law enforcement found her again, and off she headed back to the state hospital. Finally, in 1971, lawyer Marvin Belli got her paroled. She spent the rest of her life in relative obscurity, resurfacing once in the 1990s when author Jana Bombersbach approached to tell her story in a book. About this same time, Inside Edition ran its piece on Judd, which included this wild description.
To call her the Jeffrey Dahmer of 1931 still doesn't capture the horror of what she did.
While this case was tragic, I'm pretty sure it wasn't worse than Dahmer. Anyway, in her interviews with Bombersbach, Ruth, although now she went by a completely different persona and name, Marion Lane, kept to her story. She shot and killed Sammy and Anne, she said, but only in self-defense. And the reason the case became so well known, the so-called butchering of Sammy, wasn't her doing. She suspected that Jack Halloran tapped a doctor friend named Charles Brown, who once was spotted drunkenly screaming that he was the only one who knew what had happened in the trunk murders, only to be discovered dead a few days later. His death was reported to be a suicide, though he was never autopsied. Jack Halloran evaded prison, but his reputation never rebounded after his association with the case. He was in his 50s when he died in Tucson in 1939. If an obituary ran for him, I couldn't find it. Though I did see his name printed often that year, thanks to one of Ruth's escapes. Ruth, still going by Marion Lane, died peacefully in her sleep in 1998. She was 93 years old. To research this story, I read Jana Bombersbach's The Trunk Murderess, which crosses from journalism into advocacy, so I worked hard to verify what I used from the book. I also relied on contemporary news articles, a few documentaries, and interviews with key players, including Winnie Ruth Judd from a 1969 news retrospective. This case was recommended by Crimes of the Century's listener Kim Vaccarella. Thank you, Kim. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.